Okay. So, also, if you weren't here last week, and this is just taking us in to bring you up to speed where we're at, and then we're going to pick up where we left off. We looked at the different apologetic methodologies, and we're going to look at, following this, some of the arguments for the existence of God that these positions use, most notably the classical apologetics. So we talked about classical apologetics, which is their method of basically defining that there is such a thing as truth, making a case for the existence of God, which is what we're going to look at later on today. And then after they've made the case that, okay, God exists, you can argue as a classical apologist for a position of somebody becoming a theist. But let's remember, let's just keep this in our minds, that to put it frankly, you can be a theist and die and go to hell. Okay, so we're not just arguing for somebody to become a theist. We want people to become Christians. So the classical apologetic approach is first making the case that truth exists, then for theism, then showing, okay, Christianity is superior. There's more evidence for Christianity versus Islam and more evidence for Christianity versus Judaism. So that's the classical apologetic approach. Evidentialist, says, hey, let's just go straight for the big issue, if you want to call it that. Let's base everything on Jesus' resurrection. Because that they kind of look at it as that basically settles everything. I mean, if Jesus rose from the dead, we know Jesus predicted his death on three occasions, predicted his death and resurrection on three occasions. So if he did that, and he rose from the dead, well, that seems to give a pretty good case there, you know. And there's more that could be said on that, but we'll leave it at that. I went over some of this. Where I would go there, for those of you who are in the Apostles' Creed class, remember I gave a section on case for why it seems very, very credible that Jesus really did rise from the dead. And we looked at some reasons why, of how very quickly you had a bunch of Jews who were strict Jews who would never, you know, think of worshiping someone as God, worshiping Jesus as God, and then all of a sudden, you know, going there proclaiming his resurrection. And and how do you explain the birth of the church without Jesus' resurrection? That's one thing that N.T. Wright makes that case very strongly in his book, The Resurrection of the Son of God. Okay, 858 pages, just FYI. That's it. Which I haven't read.
That's one of the shorter books.
Yeah. The third one, I realized we could have said this probably last week. Fideistic apologetics, really, you could almost say, is not apologetics, because they're obviously arguing that you don't have to make a case for God's existence. We don't have to give a reason; we just believe. So there you go. Then we went to presuppositional apologetics. And that's where we ended last week. What is a presupposition? You know, a presupposition is a pre-commitment. It's something that you believe beforehand. And the presuppositional approach is saying that, as we looked at 1 Peter 3:15, a presuppositionalist is saying, as I mentioned last week, is saying that we're not, when we're having a debate, if you want to call it a debate, if we're having a discussion with someone about Christianity, proving the existence of God, the presuppositionalist, I think, rightly says, we can't pretend like the person we're talking to, and we can't pretend like we ourselves are neutral. Mm-hmm. Nobody is neutral. We all have presuppositions. And that's what the presuppositional approach is saying, that we can't let the unbeliever that we're talking to pretend like they're just neutral. You know, as if, just give me the facts, and then I'll believe. No. The Bible tells us, Romans 1 makes clear, that, in case you want to see this, because I don't want you to think I'm just making stuff up. Romans 1. This is really the issue here, and then we're gonna move on. It really starts in 1:18. I'll just read Romans 1:18. And following, it says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men." Watch. "Who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." So that's what the presuppositionalist is knowing going into this debate. That we're not going to talk with an unbeliever and let me This is a good point to make here. I think this is from John Frame in his book, Apologetics. He says, we must not present God as a conclusion to an argument, but as the one who makes argument possible. Okay? So, the unbeliever must show the basis for his or her reasoning. See, that's what we want an unbeliever to be able to show us. In your worldview, that's if you listen to the great debate between Greg Bahnsen and Dr. Stein. I don't know what his first name is. He keeps referring to him as Dr. Stein. Greg Bahnsen is the Christian. Dr. Stein is the atheist in this debate. And so what one of the things that Bahnsen would say, I know he says this to Stein, is he says, as a naturalist, as a philosophical naturalist, as a materialist, he said, how, in your worldview, does this debate even make sense? Okay? Do you understand why that's, I mean, what basis for reasoning are we using? Remember, as I said, he's a philosophical naturalist who doesn't believe in immaterial reality. Okay? And as Bahnsen shows him, well, the laws of logic are immaterial. Those are immaterial. So, so if he says, well, as a society, we've decided this is what counts as logic. And so Bahnsen says, well, in my society, this is how we decide logic works. So, you know, we might as well just say, according to your rules, you win. According to my rules, I win. And let's go home. So he wants to say, what's the basis? That's what we're talking about. Does that make sense before we move on? But that's the presuppositionalist approach, is to do that. As I said, the unbeliever's problem is, first of all, ethical before it is intellectual. Okay? It's a heart problem, first and foremost. I'll just stop there, and we'll move on to look at some more things. But that's the issue there, that knowledge is suppressed, and we want the unbeliever to give an account for their worldview. And one of the things that Bahnsen, who's the presuppositional apologetics, I know in his concluding statements, this is what he wants to bring out to show people. He wants to show people their philosophical pre-commitments. Okay? So in his conclusion, Bahnsen says this. See if you can follow the logic here. He says, in short, there is no shortage of empirical indicators or evidences of God's existence. We have evidence for God's existence. He says, from the 1,000 stars of heaven to the 500 witnesses of Christ's resurrection. But, watch this, but Dr. Stein, the atheist in the debate, precludes the very possibility of any of this empirical evidence counting as proof for God's existence. He says, in advance, Dr. Stein is committed to disallowing any theistic interpretation of nature, history, or experience. He has not at all proved by empirical observation and logic his pre-commitment to naturalism. See, that's what he wants. That's what he wants to. Okay, so you're a philosophical naturalist. Explain that to me. How we can even have a conversation? Because you've already. I mean, I can. We as Christians, we can appeal and say, "Here's Jesus. Look at his miracles that he performed." But do you see? They already have a presupposition, a pre-commitment that the supernatural is not possible. Do you see what I'm saying? So that's what we want to show them. We want to bring out, make that case to me. Make the case of how you can know that. Okay? Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what would Stein say to that? Yeah. I mean, how would he argue against it? Say the 500 witnesses.
Oh, he just keeps coming back to that. If you listen to the debate, he just keeps coming back to it over and over again. That
they weren't there, they weren't telling the truth. So
yeah, I think a lot of it is... I think it's more of the line of, gosh, who was the atheist that made the point there? Is it Hegel? And maybe it was, or was it wasn't Kant. What's more likely, that someone would rise from the dead, that a miracle would happen, or that someone would tell a lie?
Yeah.
The person writing about the 500 would lie that there were 500.
Right.
That's
mm-hmm.
Kind of
mm-hmm. So, in understanding presuppositional apologetics, this is where we left off, and let's look at this. Turn to Ephesians 4, because we want to show this point of what the Bible says here about how unbelief distorts human thought. unbelief distorts the way we think. This is the case in Ephesians 4. Galatians. There it is, Ephesians. So, Paul says, beginning in verse 17, he says, "Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do, in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to their hardness of heart." Just notice that language there. The unbelieving mind is darkened in their understanding. So that's in most English translations, that begins a new sentence, but it doesn't in the original language except in the New American Standard. But when Paul says, what Paul says here is connected to what he just said. So living in futility is connected to living in darkness. But what does that mean? He's showing us that our depravity extends to our minds. Sometimes when I remember I've said that to people in churches, and I remember in Iowa, there was a woman in our church who had said she had never heard that before, and she was really surprised by that. That our human thinking was affected by the fall, was new information to this lady who'd grown up in church. She was a veteran in her mid-50s. So are you aware of that? That the fall has also affected the way we think. I'll give you the language for that. The theologians refer to this, by the way, as the noetic effects of the fall. Okay, making sure. Effect. Noetic effects of the fall. And the reason for that is the Greek word nous, soul, or mind. Noetic effects of the fall. That the fall has affected our heart, our minds, and our will. Depravity extends to has affected every part of who we are. Okay, not in the sense. But now, this is when we say that's the Greek word nous, by the way. When we say that the fall has affected the way our minds work, please understand this, because this is what I'm referring to here. If you want, because I said that the effects of the fall have affected the totality of who we are. Theologians will refer to this as total depravity. This was basically standard thought in Christianity, from Paul all the way till about when you come to America, where we say the Unitarian Universalists, they don't really like that, so they prefer not to say that our depravity is total.
Say it's partial.
But yes, they would use partial depravity. Yeah, that's how they would describe it. Yes, partial depravity.
Redemption.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't think you can sustain it biblically. Now I'm just trying to remember where I was going with this when I brought this up. Oh, here it is. Okay, but when we say that we're depraved in its totality, here's I like the way one theologian described this. When we say that, and you know, Paul mentions this in 1 Corinthians 2, that the natural mind cannot understand the things of the Spirit. That's 1 Corinthians 2:14. The natural mind cannot understand. Okay. But when we say that our depravity has affected our minds, this is a funny line I heard somebody say once, we're not saying that an unbeliever can't identify prepositions in a sentence. Okay. That's not what we're saying. But we're talking about that there's no receptivity to spiritual truth, to embracing this, unless the Holy Spirit opens our hearts and our minds where we say this is true. Paul's not commenting, he's not saying that we can't identify prepositions in a sentence. He's saying, though, that while our intellect may be alive and well, an unbeliever's spiritual perception is darkened. Now, here's a fascinating thing. I wanted you to read that from Ephesians 4. Jesus teaches us this. This is a fascinating text. Turn to Matthew 16. This is absolutely fascinating to see this here. This is great. This is the Pharisees and the Sadducees coming to Jesus demanding a sign. I'm just setting you up here. And just watch what Jesus says.
Matthew
16. They come to Jesus, they want a sign.
verse?
Okay, it's right at the beginning, verse 1. The Pharisees and Sadducees came, and to test him, it's always a bad idea to test Jesus, by the way. They come to Jesus, they want to test him, they ask him to show them a sign from heaven. And he answered and said, I'm just going to take this little by little and then comment. Jesus says to these people who are seeking a sign, when it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening. So Jesus says, notice how he says, you can use your minds to draw correct conclusions about the natural world. So he approves of their use of empirical observation. But then he goes on, he says, you know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it. So he says, notice what he says. He says, you cannot do it. You cannot interpret the signs of the time. That's what he says in verse 3, that their problem is that they're adulterous. You see what he said? That's the issue. You're adulterous. The reason why you can't see correctly is because you love other things more than God. We love our personal autonomy more than God. We love ordering our own lives more than renouncing our lordship. And evil and adulterous hearts disorder our rational powers to the point that we're incapable of reasoning rightly about God. Do you understand that? Your loves, the things that you love and the things that you want, affect the way we think. So if our disapproval of God's existence is strong enough, then we can't see all that is there. Just think about it. These people come to Jesus and they say, perform a sign. Jesus had done signs. And when he did the signs, then what was their response? Do you remember? This is just a general question. It's not necessarily... This kind of, what is it?
You're doing the work of the devil.
That's it. I'll just attribute it to somebody else. You see what I'm saying? So it's not as if he did the signs. But then when he did the signs, they said, you're powered by Satan. The human mind is capable at justifying its unbelief in fascinating ways. We will do what we can in order to get out from under what this would actually do to us. I remember a professor in Bible college. He had a friend. My professor was a PhD in philosophy at the University of South Florida. He was talking to one of his philosopher friends. And they'd been discussing this for a while. And when it finally came down to it, you know, he said, you know, I can grant that what you've told me, that I can look around and see, yeah, you know, we obviously didn't get here by ourselves. The evidence for Jesus' death and resurrection is compelling. It's all there. And he's like, well, what is it that's holding you back? And the honest answer was, he said, from his friend, he said, I appreciate the answer. He said, if I became a Christian, it would really change my sex life. He said, I'm just not prepared to give that up. He said, well, at least he was honest. I mean, that's really what it was. He wanted to have multiple relationships with multiple women. And he knew that if he became a believer, he'd have to stop doing that. Now, again, I can go back to that and say, there's a change, there needs to be a regeneration. There needs to be new life. So he even said, it's not about the evidence. I understand. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it's one of those things where, I don't know how many more texts you want to look at, but it's there. So that's what we're saying. As a presuppositional approach, we're saying we need to go back. I mean, we can do the classical apologetics, we can do all those things, but we presuppositionalist is saying we need to understand, before we can even have that discussion, we need to let the person see. It's not, you're not approaching this as if you're just a neutral, disinterested observer. Just give me the facts. I mean, we can present, if you want to call it that, we can present the facts. This is what's interesting. You know, people say that I was reading this recently, people say that our country and our world should be secular. It shouldn't be from the intrusion of religion. And Mike Horton, who's a theologian at Westminster, California, he said, okay, that's one thing. Let's say you want to be secular. Yes. Well, what he said was, I'm fine, you know, talking to unbelievers and saying, let's have a world that's secular. He said, so long as you don't equate secular with neutral. You know, just so long as you don't equate secular with neutral. That as if for example, you know, when you're talking about politics, you can find this online if you want to. Now, this is kind of getting into some. This is by Francis Beckwith. Let me give you this philosopher. He teaches at Baylor. Francis Beckwith, and he has a great article. This is getting on social policies, but just bear with me here. The article he wrote is called, it's called Same-Sex Marriage and Legal Neutrality. And what he's showing there, because a lot of times, you know, one of the arguments for allowing same-sex marriage is that, because the argument that Christians have, and even Muslims and Jews have, are saying that marriages should be between one man and one woman is providing a religious argument. And so the idea is that, well, we're not allowed to have religious arguments. Part of the reason for that, by the way, I have to remember the other name of the article, but it's because in our law courts, religious claims, when you make a religious claim, you just need to know that the way our law courts work is that religious claims do not actually count as items of knowledge. So you just need to know that. That's in it. Beckwith, if you go to, it'll go to his personal website, and he has a lot of his academic publications. He has one on there. It's called the Court's Natural Rights and Religious Claims as Knowledge. And that's one of the things he showed. He's also, in addition to being a philosopher, he's also a legal scholar. So he's familiar with a lot of the legal. So he shows in there one of the reasons why, he gives all the cases of why we're not allowed to even mention religious arguments, because they don't actually count as an, like they would say, if it's a religious claim, then it doesn't even, it's not in the realm of knowledge. That's Kant. You see how Immanuel Kant said that? Because that's in the noumenal realm. And if it's in the noumenal realm, you can't actually know it. It's not up for, you can't actually say that you know that. You see? So what he points in here in this point, is in this article, is just to say, this is a myth. That anyone can ever remain neutral. because our laws, here's a Jamie Smith, laws are function as social nudges. The laws that we put in place in society say something about what we as a society value. Because our laws reflect what we want people in society to be. We're saying this is what something that you should value, this is something that you should approve of. So it's a myth to say you can be neutral on anything. Okay. Any questions, any thoughts?
There's a reason for excluding religious claims because, you know, I don't know if you've heard of like the flying spaghetti monster from Talk Like a Pirate Day. You can claim to believe I'm a Jedi, I believe in the flying spaghetti monster, and there is a level of you can't prove it, you can't not prove it about these kinds of religious claims, and then you get into the weeds, and it's really hard to have a concrete discussion if you don't set some ground rules. So
sure.
I think there were wise reasons for excluding, general religious claims.
But anything that becomes a construct in the human mind is a matter of faith. Science is a faith system. Nothing is more or less provable than anything else. We have a faith in God, and there's a proof for it in certain elements, I think, and people will say, well, we have, that's hocus pocus, but science is real. That's real facts.
Right.
It's not real facts. It's a faith that this is truth.
We have pre-philosophical commitments. Before we can even begin to even talk. I mean, we're all engaging in pre-philosophical commitments before we came here, trusting that our minds are reliable. We can hear and we can talk. The only thing I would say in response to that with the religious arguments, I just wonder how they would make the case then of something like human rights. Human rights is based off of religious faith. So it's just interesting how they move on from that. I wrote a brief article. Maybe I'll give it next week, and it shows some things about secularism that I think are interesting. But neither here nor there. So we're going to be done with this, and we're going to move to basic arguments for the existence of God. But any thoughts, any questions before we get done? If you have something that's...
One of my blanks.
Which ones are they?
Opposed to arguments that maintains that only the Holy Spirit can create faith
and not evidence. I'll find it.
Belief and reason.
Belief?
Okay. Belief and reason.
Belief and reason. Yeah, okay. I don't want to, if there's something that we didn't deal with. So we're just going to look at, what time is it? Was that, and I should say, if some people might say, well, I don't really need to pick a side on which approach to the existence of God, or which presuppositional, or which apologetic methodology is better than the others. It really can be cumulative. You know what I mean? It really does depend on who you're talking to. I would say that. It's not that you have to leave here and say, I'm a classical.
So I spent a couple of years in graduate school with a graduate student who was agnostic, and he loved to argue. It took me a couple of years to realize that was what he loved to do, was just argue. He wasn't actually genuinely open to faith.
Right.
But it forced me to do a lot of studying in philosophy and be able to answer his questions. But when I got really frustrated towards the end, I spoke to an older and wiser Christian who basically just pointed out what you were saying about how you can throw up an intellectual smokescreen. But it's really a heart issue, and if you haven't got to the heart, and they're not willing to open their heart and change, all the intellectual arguments you can mount would be useless.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, a lot of it is, I just look at it as, you know, just this week I got an email from someone who wants to meet. He says he's not sure if he's a Christian. He's somewhere between an atheist and Christian. But he's somebody who needs demonstrated proof of things before he can accept it. And I didn't get into it there. But there's a whole philosophical pre-commitment there of saying that we need to know, well, what counts as proof? Well, people say things like, but I just doubt. Let me write another name down for you. This is a philosopher and a scientist, Michael Polanyi. Michael Polanyi. He's a scientist and a philosopher. He has an article, I think it's called The Critique of Doubt. He's not a Christian, by the way. This guy's not a Christian. But he makes a great point. This is something that's always stuck with me, The Critique of Doubt. It's in a book of essays, so I don't know that if you look online, I've looked for it. I don't think you can just find the article. Now listen to this, and then we're going to move on. I wanted to share this with you, so I'm not wasting your time. I promise. Polanyi argues. Remember, this is coming from somebody who's not a Christian. Polanyi argues that doubt and belief are the same thing.
You just believe in something other than what the person is telling you.
He says no one can doubt two things at the same time. This comes when you're talking about somebody who's a non-Christian and says, this is what I do. I would use this if somebody says, I'm a skeptic. I just have doubts. Okay. But he said, whenever you say you're doubting one thing, at that exact same time, there's a bunch of other things that you're not doubting. And so, you can't be both dogmatic and skeptical at the same time. Does that make sense? You can't be dogmatic and skeptical at the same time. In other words, because at that point, you're basically... So when somebody says, I'm just a skeptic, or I just have doubts, well, there's obviously a whole bunch of other things that you're not doubting at the time. So what are you trusting in more? For example, so... Because if you're going to say, I'm skeptical about belief in God, But at that same time, you're obviously not skeptical about your own mind and your own reason and your own judgment of things. So, Polanyi shows, if you're going to be consistent, you have to doubt everything. So, it may seem like, you know, it's just a rhetorical argument here, or using language, but it really is helpful to say, you're not skeptical about your skepticism. You know, so there's certain things that you're not skeptical about. So what is it that you really are ultimately trusting? Do you find that helpful? Or you think, I don't really care about that. Does that make sense, though, that you can't be dogmatic and skeptical at the same time?
Because you might be able to argue from that to say, I'm skeptical about the existence of God, so what are you really trusting in? I'm trusting in that, so why are you trusting in that? Well, because I'm trusting in this, well, why are you trusting in that? And eventually get to a place where you've kind of like, not exactly proven it, but got to a place where like, well, if you believe in that, there's no way to believe in that without believing that God's there. And then you find yourself back at the beginning, you know?
Yeah, you know, I just mean, you know, so really quickly, you know, so if I'm talking to a Unitarian Universalist, if I'm talking to a Unitarian Universalist, and they're going to say, well, I don't trust the Bible. You know, it's filled with errors. Who knows what they would say? They're just people in power that are trying to get authority over me, and I just don't trust them. Well, why don't you trust them? Well, I went, you know, if they're knowledgeable. So let's assume this is a UU minister who went to seminary, because I know what they taught him there. If they went to a liberal seminary, then they learned about all the historical, what's called higher critical methods. Mm-hmm. Right, they learned about a bunch of higher critical methods that presented arguments as to why the Bible is not trustworthy. But you just need to understand, all those arguments about the historical higher critical methods are all things that can't be proven. For example, first of all, you need to know those who came up with the whole higher critical methods, their presupposition. They have a bunch of presuppositions. Their first presupposition is that the supernatural is not possible. So that's already where they begin. So they already begin with, the Bible is not reliable, miracles don't happen. So that's just a presupposition that they hold. They're not even going to argue for that. That's what they were told. And I'm just going to give you one example. That's because this is the one that I remember off the top of my head.
So hang on a second.
Yeah.
Miracles aren't possible, but yet everybody goes to heaven.
Yeah. I think that's what they would say. So now you just need to know one of their presuppositions. You can look this up online, and there are more, but this is just the one I remember. So and when they're studying the Bible, they hold to what they call, is it two S's and dissimilarity, or is it one?
Two.
It's two. Okay. Similarity. This is just one, because they have principles. So they hold. So as they're saying the Bible, I begin with the Bible is not reliable. But all of the principles that I learn as I approach the New Testament, those are reliable. One of them is called the principle of dissimilarity. The principle of dissimilarity says that as I'm reading the New Testament, this is their presupposition. This is what they hold. Anything that you read in the New Testament that is affirmed later on in church history, as like the Council of Nicaea. So anything you read in the New Testament that affirms something that came out later on in church history, you can be sure that it was the early church that went back in and corrupted the text and changed it to make it look like that's what it really said. So that's the principle of dissimilarity. That as you're reading the New Testament, if you read anything in the New Testament that affirms that Jesus is God or that he performed a miracle, you just need to know that the text has been corrupted and the church went back in and changed it.
And you say that with no evidence whatsoever.
All correct. There is no evidence for that at all whatsoever. We talked about this briefly in an elders meeting at one point. Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza is a feminist scholar at some Ivy League school. I don't know. It could be Princeton or Yale or Harvard, one of those schools. But this is just another example. Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza argues that women had a huge role to play in the early church, but the men in the church later on in church history went back and took out all the texts in the Bible that said women did anything.
Do we ever find those original texts?
No, there's nowhere. And which is interesting because you can
all burned.
Yes, they were all destroyed.
How do we know?
That's what I'm trying to tell you.
We have the ashes.
That's what I'm trying to tell you is that, which is interesting because when you put a historian on the spot, and I've seen this done before in lectures, a guy in Bible college who was there with me, he was my professor, PhD historian, somebody was like, well, how do you know anything took place in the past? Documented evidence. You know, off the top of that, that's what historians deal with, documented evidence. There is no documented evidence that ever happened. So it's just interesting that somebody at a PhD level can argue that the men in the church hundreds of years later, went back and destroyed all the evidence that, that showed that women were really, really involved in Jesus' early ministry.
Well, they certainly downplay it.
Well, no. I mean, the point is that claim is non-falsifiable. There's no way to you have to have evidence to say that men destroyed evidence because they were trying to suppress what women did. I would just say if that's the case and that Jesus was intentionally trying to downplay what women did. Again,
no,
I go back.
Jesus. Not Jesus.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying if that was the case.
So there's lots of places where the people who were writing the letters in the New Testament are addressing letters to female names, which would assume that the group of Christians that they were addressing them was being led by a woman. And that's actually in the Bible in lots of places.
Well, I mean, Phoebe, for example, and there's other...
And although Priscilla and Aquila, like, it's unusual for the wife to be addressed first and that kind of thing, so it would indicate that she has some, you know, position of religious authority. But it's just, in traditional church history, they're not talked about. They're just kind of like, we're just going to pretend that women were never in position of authority so that this sort of all-male church hierarchy is unthreatened.
I've never heard of that.
So what's more likely, that the men destroyed the text that nobody can find, or that one woman is telling a lie?
Yeah, good point. I was just going to say, because this is something that goes for the resurrection. I mean, it's just crazy that, you know, if the resurrection didn't happen, as Paul says, right, then we're of all people most to be pitied, right? And then yet, after the resurrection, Jesus says to the women, go tell them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is, a woman's testimony wasn't allowed in court. So anyways, I'm just saying that's just interesting. Anyways, okay. But let's move on to some of the basic arguments for the existence of God. This really shouldn't take that long. And I'm not trying to rush through it. I just wanted to make sure. Just remind myself. So this would be what you would find, you know, in a class you took on this. So one of the arguments is the cosmological argument. This is what we're going to look at now are going to be some of those that the classical apologists would use. You may have heard this. That's why I'm not trying to, waste your time. Let's just look at this, for example. And maybe you'll find this helpful, maybe not. So what is the cosmological argument? It's based on the cosmos, right? That's a Greek word, means world. Seeking to give evidence for God's existence by stating that everything that exists had to have a cause. Remember I said this is a classical apologist, could sometimes be referred to as a Thomist apologist. That's Thomas Aquinas, because this comes from Aquinas. So the syllogism, that's the logical outline. Everything that had a beginning had a cause. The universe had a beginning. Therefore, the universe had a cause. So that's kind of where they go. Thomas Aquinas used this he called it his argument from motion. Things in motion could not have brought themselves into motion, but must be caused to move. Remember I said Thomas relied heavily on Aristotle. Aristotle referred to God, who was not the God of the Bible, but he referred to God as the unmoved mover. That's where Aquinas is getting this from. He's the unmoved mover. Okay, that's who God is. That's the argument comes. The universe had to have been brought into being by someone or something. Didn't get here by itself. There must be cause and effect. Right?
Stephen Hawking is going to be really upset.
Yeah. And those who use this argument would be willing to talk about the Big Bang. They're just going to say God is the one who brought that into being, that caused the bang and brought everything into existence. I know if you're a scientist, you want me to go into a lot more detail, and I'm not going to. I'm going to keep it simple. Everything that comes to be has a cause, and the universe came to be. Since the universe had a beginning, it must have had a beginner. I know the next question that always gets raised is, who made God? But just notice how the argument is stated. The law of causality does not say everything needed a cause. It says that everything that comes to be needs a cause. Does that make sense? Everything that had a beginning had a cause. Okay, that's how the argument is stated. So, God is eternal. No one made God. Any thought? Again, that's really all the detail I'm going into. This is just saying that we look at the world as did everything that come to be in the world come by itself, or did God, even if you hold evolution, whatever. I'm just saying, God brought in. You're gonna say something now.
I was gonna say that was the one of the opening points in the Great Debate too, where he said, said you know, basically that because there's nothing supernatural, there cannot be anything that is non-linear in time, and therefore there has to something had to have created God because God had to have a beginning.
Yeah, then you get an infinite regress, right? It just keeps going back and back and back and back and back.
Totally
back
way
back.
Down.
Yeah. So, any thoughts on that? I mean, if you find that, I mean, again, yes, it's true. That's why I'm saying here from the classical apologist approach. Do you have to be a Christian to affirm that? No. Right? I mean, Jews hold to that, Muslims hold to that. But we're just beginning there, saying how, that's the cosmological argument. Aquinas used that. Look at the world around you. Did someone create this? That's where we're starting with, the worlds. So that's a famous one, and we're going to look at I believe four, right? So these all hold together now. There's the cosmological argument, the next one, these two usually go together. The teleological argument. Teleological comes from the Greek word telos, purpose. Sometimes this is referred to as the argument from design. It's a pretty powerful argument. I do think this is pretty powerful. It's the precision of the universe that is persuasive. And again, there's the syllogism. Every design had a designer. The universe has a highly complex design. Therefore, the universe had a designer. And scientists, again, some of you who are more scientifically minded, I'm going to read from, this is Norman Geisler, who's a classical apologist. This is his book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. This is written a long time ago. I'm going to call it a long time ago. When was it published? I'm saying you might consider it dated, but it was published in 2004. Not like it was in the 1970s. I'm just saying, if you were looking for a recent book, you might not want to buy this. That's all I'm saying, to take more things into account. Because he appeals to scientific evidence. And so I don't know if you would say, well, we have better information now. Mm-hmm. You know, we have more discoveries. I don't know. So, and the reason I pointed that is because he looks at what are referred to as he refers to the anthropic principle, anthropic constants. An anthropic constant is, an anthropic constant is something that makes it possible for us to have life here. Am I right? Okay, there you go. And there's a certain series of things that have to be the way they are in order for human beings to even live on this earth, okay? He lists... Let me go to this here. He lists them on page 105 in this book. Let me remind you. Like, this is what I mean. So if you're up to date on all this stuff, feel free to correct Norman Geisler. So, for example, he mentions, you know, oxygen level. So he says, on Earth, oxygen comprises 21% of the atmosphere. That precise figure is an anthropic constant that makes life on Earth possible. If oxygen were 25%, fires would erupt spontaneously. If it were 15%, human beings would suffocate. Does that sound right? That's what I'm saying. I'm quoting from him, so you have to correct him. He also refers to gravity as an anthropic constant. But here they are. So he lists some of the anthropic constants that have to be, these are things that have to be precise in order for us to live here. So he says, if the centrifugal force of planetary movements did not precisely balance the gravitational forces, nothing could be held in orbit around the sun. If the universe had expanded at a rate 1 millionth more slowly than it did, expansion would have stopped, and the universe would have collapsed on itself before any stars had formed. If it had expanded faster, then no galaxies would have formed. Any of the laws of physics can be described as a function of the velocity of light, now defined to be 299,792,458 meters per second. Even a slight variation in the speed of light would alter the Earth, would alter the other constants and preclude the possibility of life on Earth. I don't know if this is just jumble, you know, or does this make sense? Okay. he says, if water vapor levels in the atmosphere were greater than they are now, a runaway greenhouse effect would cause temperatures to rise too high for human life. If they were less, an insufficient greenhouse effect would make the Earth too cold to support human life. If Jupiter were not in its current orbit, the Earth would be bombarded with space material. Jupiter's gravitational field acts as a cosmic vacuum cleaner, attracting asteroids and comets that might otherwise strike Earth. If the thickness of the Earth's crust were greater, too much oxygen would be transferred to the crust to support life. If it were thinner, volcanic and tectonic activity would make life impossible. So again, even if we don't understand this, he's saying this is things that have to be precise the way they are. If the rotation of the Earth took longer than 24 hours, temperature differences would be too great between night and day. If the rotation period were shorter, atmospheric wind velocities would be too great. The 23-degree axial tilt of the Earth is just right. If the tilt were altered slightly, surface temperatures would be too extreme on Earth. If the atmospheric discharge, lightning, rate were greater, there would be too much fire destruction. If it were less, there would be too little nitrogen fixing in the soil. If there were more seismic activity, much more life would be lost. If there were less, nutrients on the ocean floors and in river runoff would not be cycled back to the continents through tectonic uplift. Yes, even earthquakes are necessary to sustain life as we know it. Those are the 10. He just lists 10. I'll stop there. Again, I don't even understand all that, but the point is, it seems to speak to a designer. That something is here, that God makes this possible. Is this, or is this just by accident? That's the idea there. Any thoughts?
I guess you could say if any of those constants were different, there might still be life on Earth, just not as we know it.
Yeah, okay. So it's a little bit of circular reasoning there. Some of them are stronger arguments than others, but like the thing with the oxygen levels, I mean, you could just have a different creature. Instead of being carbon-based, you'd be silicon-based, and you have the oxygen. But like some of the other ones were like, you know, a centrifugal force versus, you know, whatever the other one that was in balance with that. Mm-hmm. Like that would be true no matter what kind of life form you needed, because they'd be able to stay on the planet. So.
Mm-hmm. There you go. That's why it's important to have philosophers. That's why, from what I understand, this is why scientists hate philosophers. That's what I hear. That's why we need to have Dan here, because he's a philosopher of science. He could help us all out. Those are just two arguments that you should just know about: cosmological, teleological. Just looking at the argument from design. The next one is a more philosophical argument. You might even say your brain might hurt a little bit after this, and you're not even going to care. But nevertheless, you should hear it and know about it because it's famous and it's considered important. And you would learn about this in a class. It's called the ontological argument. This comes from a philosopher. This is Anselm of Canterbury, who lived from 1033 to 1109. The argument attempts to prove the existence of God through abstract reasoning alone. It's known as an a priori argument. That is to say, it's without empirical observation. It asserts, this is a Benedictine monk, Anselm, argues, and he asserts that the very idea of God is proof that God exists. Okay, just, you know, see what you think, okay? This is famous. This is a famous argument that people have, some have appreciated more than others. You can see it there. God has all perfections. There's some presuppositions here, but this is what he argued. He says that God has all perfections. Existence is a perfection, therefore God exists. He defines God as that than which no greater can be conceived. And he's arguing there that existence is a perfection. So, I'm trying to see how much... Okay, yeah. Let me look at this. Okay. I wrote it on there, yeah.
Would this be described in like that layman expression that we've all probably heard, that everybody seems to have, you know, a puzzle part missing, you know, and then God's the only one that can fill it.
Is this kind of like that?
It's sort of the idea of...
It's kind of more of a word argument.
Yeah.
If you can name something, and the thing you're trying to name is an idea.
Correct.
The fact that you can name it proves that the idea is...
Right. I'm gonna.
Why do people, you know... I mean, this seems to fall along the line of why do people seek for God? Mm-hmm. You know, why do they... You know, why do they seem to look for a God?
That's an argument, but it's not this argument.
Does this only apply to God, too?
That's the pushback that Anselm gets. Yeah. Because the idea is that if I can conceive of a ghost, does that mean ghosts exist? But nevertheless, that's what I'm saying. It seems like the receptivity to this argument is getting less and less as we move forward in history. But that is what he said. And some people found it very interesting. So more formally, this is the way Frame characterizes it. He says, by definition, God is a being than which none greater can be imagined. A being that necessarily exists in reality is greater than a being that does not necessarily exist. Thus, by definition, if God exists as an idea in the mind, but does not necessarily exist in reality, then we can imagine something that is greater than God. But we cannot imagine something that is greater than God. Thus, if God exists in the mind as an idea, then God necessarily exists in reality. 6, God exists in the mind as an idea, therefore God necessarily exists in reality. Yes. Is your brain hurting yet? But that's what he's arguing.
It's not just ghosts. You can just fill an X there. Like, he's defining God as the greatest possible thing you can imagine.
Right.
And so, you said you can't imagine anything greater by logical consistency, inconsistency. Like, he just establishes an inconsistency and then goes, well, that means one of these things must be false, so I'm going to pick one of them and then keep going. It really only applies to, like, just imagine the greatest thing you can imagine. You can call it X. X is the greatest thing I imagine, so therefore X must be exist. You know, that's like...
Correct.
But it's not ghosts. Like, you have to define it to be, like, the utmost of every possible good variable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I'm not expecting that any of you here are going to leave and say, I'm going to use the ontological argument with my friends. I'm just making you aware of it, that in history, this is one of the arguments that people have made, and they still refer to this, because Anselm is well known.
And if you're a Catholic, you can be excommunicated for not believing it.
Really? I didn't know that. Okay. So let's deal with something that's more...
Dr. Aquinas read that.
Okay.
Announcement.
Oh, really?
Before we started class.
Oh, okay.
We're all in trouble.
Yeah. The moral argument. I wouldn't necessarily use it either. I mean, I can look at it and read it and say, okay, yeah.
Well, I'm struggling to understand why it lasted at all.
I don't know. I really couldn't give you that answer. I mean, in the history of philosophy, you know, maybe it's just something, it's almost like maybe it's in Acts 17, where Paul is in Athens and he's talking to the philosophers there, and it says what these people did that Paul is talking to. Basically, all they did was sit around and talk about ideas all day. And since Paul was somebody that had an idea, they're like, yeah, let's listen to Paul for a little bit. So maybe that's how this came up. Just somebody sitting around talking. And remember, they didn't have a lot. I wonder what they did. I mean, what was their free time like in 1033? To 1109.
It sounds like a college dorm conversation.
Perhaps. Yeah.
Remember, this is also before the Enlightenment, before the scientific revolution, before different kinds of...
Yeah.
Well, what's wrong with it is actually pretty subtle. Because it involves saying something that's internally contradictory, like the town with the barber that shaves everybody in the town who doesn't shave himself. Mm-hmm. So who shaves the barber? Mm-hmm. This is another version of that same thing where you have classes of things and you suddenly find out that there's something wrong with the way you pay your classes. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until 150 years ago that people started thinking about the logic that would get you out of that problem.
But so let's move and then think about this then. The moral argument is a pretty powerful argument. The moral argument basically says that without God, you can't have objective moral standards. So proponents of the moral argument suggest that as you look at different cultures, C.S. Lewis used this in Mere Christianity, you look at different cultures, there does seem to be a kind of moral code that's universal. That's what Lewis brings up. You know, he says, in all societies... he says, bravery and loyalty are said to be good, and greed and cowardice are said to be bad. He's like, there's no society that exists where a greedy person or a coward is said to be a good person. So the question is, we seem to live with a sense. We seem to live with a sense that certain things are good. And this is asking, where do we get that sense from? Where does that come from? That's what the moral argument is. So if we didn't believe there was such a thing as right and wrong, well, then why would we have debates with people? Right? Or why would we talk? Why would we argue for our various positions? If there's no moral law that transcends all cultures, then everything seems to be arbitrary. So that's what we're talking about here. And this is Geisler brings up this, which you looked at really quickly. He said, if there's no objective moral good or bad, he asked the question, then how do we say, why would we say that Mother Teresa is a better person than Adolf Hitler? So that may be better. There's no society in which people say Adolf Hitler was a great, you know, well, I guess there are even some of those. But what do we do when we hear that? We're like, what are you talking about? Or Osama bin Laden. You know what I mean? Is there an objective standard? Or how would we say, why was one better than the other? That's what Geisler's talking about. And he says, and I think he's right, and others pointed this out too, the main way we see that this moral law is undeniable is in our reactions. Is in our reactions to people. So someone may claim that stealing is not wrong. But how do they act if you steal something from them? So the worldview is just unlivable. I know he gives an example in there about a professor, philosophy professor at the University of Indiana, who gave his students an assignment to write a research paper. He said the students could write on any topic they wanted as long as they provided documentation and defended their point. And so we had a student in the class that decided to defend moral relativism. That's what the student wrote his paper on, moral relativism. And in the paper he said, all morals are relative. There is no absolute standard of justice or rightness. It's all a matter of opinion. You like chocolate, I like vanilla. So the student turned in the paper on time. It was the right length, the punctuation, everything was immaculate. And of course, you know, the philosophy professor had to teach him a lesson. So he gave him an F. And of course, the student was very upset about it. And he said, aren't you the student that said there's no such thing as rightness, fairness, or justice? It's all a matter of opinion. The student said, yes, that's my view. The professor said, well, fine, you get an F. Of course, I mean, you can see the point there. Obviously, he's just trying to make a point. You know, that's the philosopher's dream, to be able to do something like that. For a student to say, I don't believe in absolutes, and then say, well, obviously you do. You know what I mean? You are upset. Okay. It's unlivable. And I think Geisler's right. He says, the moral law is not always the standard by which we treat others, but it is nearly always the standard by which we expect others to treat us. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, so that's the reality of the situation. I know there's other examples that could be given, and we can talk about that. But any thoughts up to this point? What do you think about that? Of what we've heard so far, which argument do you think, you know, appeals to you as something that you would use or that you find? I'm just throwing out a question so I can stop talking for a little bit.
What I've known about science and the universe and learning. It takes more faith for me to believe that there is no God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the cosmological, or just looking at the universe, the world, or the teleological? Yeah. Yeah. Any others? Any other thoughts?
My brother-in-law is a Jew who is now a Buddhist.
Okay.
And he teaches Buddhist theology. He's a trainer and whatever. But so we talk about this, and he's part of the things that Buddhists have to do is good things, right things. Mm-hmm. So I ask him, what's the standard? You know, what's right? Well, you know it internally. You know what's right and what's wrong. Mm-hmm. So, well, who decides? Because there's other people who are not you and me who mm-hmm. decide that they're going to steal, rob, do mm-hmm. all these bad things. Isn't that right? Isn't that coming from the same place? Isn't that coming from internally like that? He said, yes, but they're wrong. I said, well, okay, so who's the standard? Where's the standard come from? And it, as you drive him farther and farther towards that point where he has to say where it comes from, it becomes an imponderable.
Right.
Which is a name that they say, okay, you've gone, we can't tell you that. You know, the Buddha would say that's an imponderable. Okay. Don't ask those questions.
Yeah. So,
I guess I'm maybe I'm not reading it correctly, but the way I'm understanding the ontological argument, it seems to be what God's argument is in Romans 1.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it just seems like these are all called arguments, right?
Right, yeah.
So if we're prone to argue,
yeah, yeah,
But God does all the work anyway. You know, and we sort of just need to be healthy. So it seems like the ontological reflects what God's saying in Romans 1.
Yeah. The last one is tied to the presuppositionalist approach. This is, if you remember, Greg Bahnsen used what he referred to as the transcendental argument. He called it the transcendental argument. This is a very authoritarian argument. As you can tell there, the argument is that, he says this in the argument, that without God you can't prove anything. And he says that God exists because of the impossibility of the contrary. That's his argument. That's what he says. You're probably unfamiliar with this, but I'm trying to see what to say here. He argues this because he's the only one I've heard that uses it, the transcendental argument. But the transcendental argument argues that without the Christian understanding of God, one cannot account for rationality, science, logic, or morality. And this is because Bahnsen is a presuppositionalist who is not just trying to convince you to become a theist. He wants you to become a Christian, which is good. That's what he's arguing for. That's why he says, without the Christian worldview specifically, nothing makes sense. That's the argument. Whether you think that's kind of going overboard or not, that's what he deals with. It gets to the heart of the issue. He says God is the foundation of knowledge. There's more that could be said here, but he actually gets into a little bit to the moral argument as well. I remember in his closing arguments, Dr. Stein, the atheist there, his argument that he uses that for not believing God's existence is the problem of evil. He says there's too much evil in the world. God, if he does exist, would never allow that. What he points out in his closing arguments, Bahnsen says that there is no problem. He says that worldview, what worldview are you using to say, how can you define what is evil? That's what he's asking him. How? What's the presupposition that is somewhere in your heart or mind that allows you to decide between what is right and wrong? He said, if anything, what it means for you as an atheist is that, he says, there is no problem of evil. That's what he says to the atheist. He says, there is no problem of evil because there's no standard right and wrong. In a materialist's universe, all one can say is that it is a psychological or emotional problem. Maybe there's a chemical imbalance in the brain, but there can be no philosophical problem. So just because an atheist who's a materialist says, I would never believe in God because there's too much evil in the world, he's saying, but again, everything is reduced to the material world. He said, why can't it just be a problem in your brain? But your brain, what's in your brain, it's all chemical reactions in the brain. But what's in your brain is not what's in my brain. You know, and he brought that up. Marquis de Sade was somebody who, for him, what was fun to him was torturing women. And that's what he liked to do. He brought that up to Dr. Stein. He said, tell me how that's wrong.
In your worldview.
Yeah, and explain in your worldview how that's wrong, if there's no right or wrong. So what do you think in that? I mean, I remember when I read that, when I heard him say that, I thought, I think that's an interesting point. To the philosophical naturalist to say, you might not like it, but how in your worldview do you define something as evil? And how is it not just an emotional problem or just something subjective that you don't like? But how can you actually explain it, though? Does that make sense?
Well, it kind of sidesteps, though, because what Stein might have said is that I can't accept that there's a God. If I accept that there's a God, then I have to also accept that all this bad stuff I don't like, all those you know, chemical reactions are producing things that I don't like, that those things are evil. And there's so much evil that your worldview with God in it also has evil in it, and it's self-inconsistent. Like, he might have been trying to say that, and for him, and so for Bahnsen to be like, well, you can't even use the word evil because your worldview doesn't have evil in it, is kind of not really getting to the core of that self-inconsistency argument.
Say it again? Say that again?
Sorry. I won't waste your time. It's okay.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make sure I heard you correctly. Did I leave it back here? Okay. Well, we only have 5 minutes. So I probably shouldn't pass out this paper, then, should I? Next time. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I shouldn't pass out this paper. So
you'll just have to pass that out again next week.
Right. So that's kind of a good place to end, a good segue, because so next week we're gonna talk about the so-called problem of evil, and we're gonna do some theology. We're gonna have to do a lot of background, not a lot. We're gonna do some background work to really even understand what theology is, and before we address this issue, and that's all we're gonna deal with. That's all we're going to have time to get to. Forever, 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 forever.